On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What began as a leak over the weekend has exploded into a full-fledged new chapter in the grinding debate over America's war in Iraq. Under intense pressure on the home stretch to midterm elections, the president yesterday ordered the release of excerpts of the National Intelligence Estimate's classified assessment on the global terrorist threat. And now the public has to decide what it means. The report clearly says that Iraq has become a huge rallying point and training ground for global terrorism. This is not what the country was promised. On the other hand, it says losing in Iraq could make things worse. Up next on Point, the battle over American public opinion on Iraq. Joining me from Washington first today is Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for The New York Times. He was one of the reporters who broke the story of leaked intelligence, the leaked intelligence report conclusions over the weekend. Mark, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here you were over the weekend really stirring things up. The headlines, spy agencies say Iraq war worsens terrorism threat. First of all, with more of this report now released, how does your leaked reporting stand up?
We think that it holds up very well. We noticed the day after our story ran, the White House didn't challenge any of the substance of the report. They just said that we had pulled out parts of the report and had mischaracterized it. Now that the key judgments are declassified, we think that our original story does hold true. And this was just to dispel impressions that had been left. I mean, this was not something that was leaked to the New York Times. This was something that you know, took several weeks of reporting. It wasn't something that was timed with the upcoming November elections.
Nevertheless, it sits right on the road to those elections. You talked with a dozen people to put this together from a classified report. On the other hand, I don't see much in your original reporting that speaks to this issue of the conclusion that a victory in Iraq would encourage, or I guess they put it the other way around. The intelligence report says a loss in Iraq by the insurgents would discourage them. This, the White House has picked up and said, look, there it is. We've got to win here.
I know. I certainly think that the key judgments of the report might have some fuel for both sides. The National Intelligence Estimate does say that if jihadists were to perceive to have failed, fewer might join the fight. But at the same time, the estimate says that all of the trends of global terrorism are getting worse over the next 5 years, and that to some extent, the things that are fueling the global jihad movement are more powerful than its own vulnerabilities.
So when the president said earlier this month in Atlanta that America is winning the war on terror, does the report support that assertion?
The report doesn't make any direct claims to that or to the contrary. It doesn't say we're winning or it doesn't say we're losing. And that's not the job of national intelligence estimates, really. They're to sort of lay the groundwork for where the intelligence community believes the trends are. It wouldn't make a really definitive judgment on that. But it does, you know, have some very sobering conclusions about the state of the global jihad movement.
Just a spreading global jihadist movement fueled by corrupt and unjust governments in Muslim-majority countries, fueled by pervasive anti-U.S. sentiment among Muslims, fueled by Iraq. And this conclusion, the underlying factors fueling the spread of the movement outweigh its vulnerabilities. Interpret that for us, Mark.
That basically means that these four main factors they identify are strong right now and getting stronger, and that over the next 5 years, this estimate predicts that these things will be more powerful than the internal vulnerabilities of the Islamic radical movement.
That presents a tough picture for the U.S. There's still a call out there for more of this document to be released. Do you think this is it? Is this all we're going to see?
My guess is that this is all we will see, at least for the near term. As we know, the White House very reluctantly declassified these key judgments, and the question is whether Republicans, including Pat Roberts on the Senate Intelligence Committee, will continue calls for more of the document to be released. If it's only Democrats asking for it, it probably won't happen. But in this case, you had some very powerful Republicans who were asking for it to be declassified, and so that's why we got some of the key judgments yesterday. The people I've spoken to said, while in the main body of the report, there is certainly a lot more of Iraq analysis, there is not the body is broadly consistent with the key judgments of the report.
Your paper today is quoting Bruce Hoffman at Georgetown University saying, I guess the overall conclusion that you get from it is that we don't have enough bullets given all the enemies we are creating. Does it look like that's the judgment that's coming out in security circles on this report, that we're breeding, terrorists are breeding as a result of all kinds of things faster than the U.S. can deal with them?
It has been the judgment for a little while that in security circles among terrorist experts like Bruce Hoffman that defeating radical Islam is not just going to be capturing and killing terrorists. And in fact, the NIE says that it's going to take a lot more than just offensive military action. So Bruce Hoffman's quote is right in the sense that it will not take the U.S. military going around the world killing and capturing jihadists. That is a losing proposition if that is the main strategy.
And what about classified intelligence reports? Are those a thing of the past? Are we going to be reading them in the New York Times, their conclusions here on out? Or is this a product of the unique, huge pressures, political pressures on the road to midterms? What do you think?
No, I think that they're not going to be declassifying every subsequent national intelligence estimate, nor particularly should they declassify everyone. There is a need for classified information, but there is also a need for the assessments of experts to get out in some declassified format that's not harming national security. It is something that is this is the expertise of 16 different intelligence agencies in the government. So it's a pretty conclusive estimate.
Mark Mazzetti, thanks very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with us from Washington. We're looking this hour at the American public grappling with battling views on Iraq. We're joined now by two experts on military action and public opinion. Joining me first from Durham, North Carolina, is Christopher Gelpy, professor of political science at Duke University and co-author of Choosing Your Battles, American Civil-Military Relations and the Use of Force. Christopher Gelpy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And from Princeton, New Jersey, Dominic Johnson joins us. He's a fellow in the Society of Fellows at Princeton University, co-author of the new book, Failing to Win, Perceptions of Victory and Defeat in International Politics. Dominic Johnson, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
Christopher Gelpy, take us right in here. Your co-author on this book, Peter Fever, is now sort of right at the heart of the White House National Security Council strategy and messaging operation. You've written about how the American Republic responds to war and to this war. How do you think this latest big round with the National Intelligence Estimate is going to affect public opinion?
Well, I don't think it's likely to move the public a whole lot one way or another, because just as we were hearing before, the estimate is of a sort of a half full, half empty variety. That is, one can read at least the summary judgments there and draw some pretty daunting conclusions about Iraq and its impact on the war on terror. On the other hand, the president just as easily drew from it and said, no, what it means is we have to win. So I think each side can draw what they want from what has been declassified and make the arguments that they're already making.
Dominic Johnson, and yet here we are in the midst of a very costly war, costly in many ways, not least to a sense of American unity on this thing. How do you see the ongoing story of the public trying to deal with such very different presentations, interpretations of the Iraq War? Where does that lead us?
Right. Well, I agree with everything Christopher just said. So the book with Dominic Tierney just states very clearly that it's a common historical phenomenon that people often judge victory and defeat on the basis of things that have nothing to do with what's really going on the ground. So in Iraq, for example, there are a lot of factors which are influencing people's perceptions over and above tangible gains and losses. And key in this case is partisanship. You can see in polls of pretty much any question about Iraq, there's absolutely diametrically opposite views depending on people's party affiliation. So I think that's exactly why people will look at this report and take whatever they want to see from it.
But yet, at some point, citizens in a democracy have to make judgments on the basis of some kind of reality this report, I think people are jumping on it because they're looking for something that's solid. So do you see it on balance as suggesting, you know, to a responsible citizen that supporting this war is a good idea or not?
Well, that's what's so interesting about it. It seems like this is going to be a set of concrete facts, which will tell us finally once and for all, are we winning or not? But the public is split on whether we're winning or losing, and I think they'll remain split after reading the documents. So there are many things you can read from it that support Bush's position. For example, the report was published in April, and it has many recommendations for what could be done to improve the efforts in the war on terror. So, for example, it says if al-Zarqawi is captured, it should significantly improve the U.S. position. And, of course, he was killed in June.
So, here, Chris Gelpie, remind us of the work that you did with Peter Feaver, who is now right there in the wheelhouse with the Bush administration working on this. You came out about a year ago saying if Americans believe they're on a path to victory, they're going to stay with this. And so, what's happened since then?
Right. Well, we have just completed a book manuscript looking at public opinion, American public opinion towards various wars, including a number of surveys looking at Iraq. And we find a pretty consistent result that perceptions of the likely success of the mission are the most influential factor in determining whether people are willing to continue the fight. So that's part of why this national intelligence estimate, I think, is so potentially important, because it could influence people's perceptions of the likelihood of success. But for the reasons that Dominic pointed out, I think this particular document is ambiguous enough that partisan preferences can allow people to interpret it as they wish. I do think that there may be other kinds of events that are less manipulable and less subject to partisan interpretation. So I wouldn't deny that partisanship is an important part of people's formation of their beliefs, but I think there are objective events out there. We talked about, you know, capturing Hussein or capturing Zarqawi or the elections in December 2005. Each of those are sort of real-world events that did seem to kind of move the center in terms of their perceptions of success. Mm. What has happened over time, though, I think, is we've seen that as people have sort of solidified their views, it becomes more and more difficult to move them or to overwhelm their sort of predispositions.
But you wrote with Peter Feaver, as I understood it, you know, sort of talk about it in terms of victory because that will keep people on board. But yet, in the end, Americans don't want happy talk. And now we look at this report and it says terrorists are increasing in both number and geographic dispersion. That continuation of the trend would lead to, quote, to increasing attacks worldwide. That doesn't sound like safer. That sounds like less safe. So where's the victory there?
Right. Well, I want to be clear in saying our research didn't tell the White House to talk about victory. That may have been the lesson that they drew, but our research is about people's perceptions of success and how that affects their willingness to fight. And we didn't argue that if you just say victory, then they will believe that we're going to win. So my own view is that events on the ground matter quite a bit. So I don't want to be viewed as saying I just told the White House to say victory.
Is that the message they got somehow?
Well, I mean... It certainly appears to be a message that's coming through. It may be that that's simply the message that they could implement, right? That I'm sure that they would love to win the war on the ground in Iraq. Mm-hmm. I'm just not sure that they know how to do that. But they do know how to say victory, so that's what they can do.
Dominic Johnson, you've said the American public is defeat-phobic. That's number one. They just don't want to defeat. How's that playing out as these new conclusions and findings are laid before the public?
Right. Well, Chris and Peter's book actually say that the myth that the public is casualty phobic is wrong, and what the American public actually is defeat phobic. Mm-hmm. And what our book tries to do is find out what determines whether people think a particular foreign policy venture is a victory or defeat. So I think particularly important in this case is the fact that Iraq is actually a nation-building mission now. And if you look at past historical conflicts, Americans have typically been pretty disliking of nation-building ventures. So, for example, if you look at Somalia, Haiti, Kosovo, all relatively successful interventions, Americans nevertheless were not particularly happy to support them, certainly when there were even minimal casualties. And that's very important in Iraq. The invasion itself was very successful. The invasion coincided with a very big increase in people's perceptions that the war on terror was being won. But, of course, had nothing to do with it. And these events are critical in forming people's perceptions over and above partisanship.
Let's turn to our callers. Richard's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Richard. You're on the air. What do you see here?
Well, I wanted to make a comment about something I read. An ex-CIA officer, Ray Close, just recently put up a post on a blog that was discussing how big of a deal the NIE is, that it's a really very comprehensive report, and also pointing out that on Sunday talk shows, all of the lawmakers, none of them had seen the report, and he found it very troubling. And it seems to me and to him that we're making decisions based on ideology instead of instead of using our intelligence community. I'm sure this happens on both sides, but for the neoconservatives in particular, it seems to have had really dire consequences. It seems like President Bush is acting on ideology instead of intelligence.
Is that equally true of his critics in this case, now that the report's out? How do you see that, Richard?
Well, I don't know. I think it is to a certain extent. I think what's better about it, or not better, but the consequences of their actions aren't nearly as dire as those of the conservatives.
Yeah, we take that point. Dominic Johnson, what about it? You've looked across history at how publics in the States and elsewhere look at military conflicts. Leaders often have a big interest in portraying those conflicts in a certain way. Do you see the portrayal this time as based in part on ideology? And how far can that go before reality bites?
Right, absolutely. Well, it is important in Iraq. It's particularly important in Iraq because the conflict itself is the worst possible sort of situation. It's a very ambiguous conflict. You can draw any interpretation you want from it and find it hard to find evidence which contradicts your view. It's a nation-building mission, which I mentioned before, Americans don't like. And it's particularly difficult because it's the U.S. which is primarily fighting it. And as we found throughout history, what you find is that big, powerful democratic nations are the ones which find it harder to generate a perception of victory. Because firstly, people expect a lot of them. How can the single superpower of the world not win in a small conflict like Iraq? And it's democratic, so it incites all sorts of criticism. And, for example, the newspaper reports of the National Intelligence Estimate itself conjures up an intense debate in the U.S., which makes it very hard for the administration to steer perceptions, especially in contrast to a tyranny, for example.
But is it possible in history, do you see examples where a public is led to expect one outcome and then suddenly, boom, they've got an undeniable defeat on their hands and somehow didn't see it coming or it wasn't?
Absolutely. Well, the clearest example is the Tet Offensive in 1968. In the fall of 1967, President Johnson and General Westmoreland were telling people that the war was going well, the light is at the end of the tunnel. And then at the end of January 1968, the communists launched their massive Tet Offensive across South Vietnam. And it was this single event which convinced people that what their expectations, irrespective of the reality, were just completely unfounded and set the scene for a perception of defeat, even though, in fact, the military situation on the ground was significantly improved by a successful U.S. Counterattack.
Let's take a call from Charleston, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. What do you think?
I think a lot, but if I could, I'd just like to make a statement first and then give you my perception. I believe the only way to resolve the issue with the extremists, the Muslim extremists, is to get the moderate Muslims involved in some way. You know, all of the fence sitters in the Mideast and across the world are waiting to see what happens in Iraq. The more we indicate we're going to lose that war, the more the fence sitters are either going to sit on the fence or they're going to fall off on the wrong side. So I think it's counterproductive to us in the nation and maybe to the world in the long run to keep denigrating our efforts in the Mideast.
But what if they're not working? What if they're actually not working? I mean, the report says we're breeding more terrorists, that the trend line is toward more vulnerability.
If you're talking short-term, mid-term, long-term, I think in long-term verbiage, we can say that it's a bad idea to denigrate what we are doing. In the short term, maybe it fixes some of our tactics and techniques and procedures and helps us better work the issue in the Mideast. But I have great difficulty in accepting what
Mark Mazzetti, the New York Times reporter.
Mark Mazzetti has done, because I think he has either cherry-picked the document himself or somebody, a disaffected bureaucrat who does not have a very large vision of what's going on, has cherry-picked the document and given us something that distorts and perverts the document itself.
But, you know, you've got many Americans who also say intelligence was cherry-picked to take us into Iraq. You've got a lot of people who say, well, intelligence was cherry-picked to get us in there in the first place. I mean, cherry-picking works all kinds of ways, doesn't it?
I think that, though, I believe is speculative. I think this is, you cannot refute the fact that this was cherry-picked. You are making the assumption, by the way, and I've said this before in other discussions with other people, that I've worked in Washington. I understand how decisions are made. I understand how information is projected and presented. And, you know, to blame particularly the president for cherry-picking, I believe, is, as I told someone, is a canard. It just doesn't work. But there is a particular party who is trying to, and I think in a very feckless way, gain some national political leverage domestically, you know, at the expense of us in the world. And I believe that some people don't realize what they are doing.
William, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Chris Gelpe, here's the charge. You know, these charges that fly both ways, cherry-picking both ways. Fecklessness, that one certainly flies both ways.
Yeah, I think one can have a debate about whether it's a good idea for newspapers to be running stories that leak classified information. But in terms of whether or not the original story was cherry-picked, it seems to me that now we've had the conclusions, which are, by the way, cherry-picked by the Bush administration. That is not the entire conclusion.
It's just a fractional excerpting
is published. But so we've seen the section of the conclusions that the Bush administration would like to declassify. And yet it seems to me that the basic conclusions of the original story stand up. That is, I mean, the key paragraph is the one about where the NIE says that Iraq has become the cause celeb for radical Islam.
Breeding a deep resentment of U.S. involvement in the Muslim world, cultivating supporters for the global jihadist movement.
Right. So it seems to me that the initial report was roughly correct about what the NIE says. The bigger question then is, what lesson do we take from it? And that is where I think we end up having to get into ideology for some of the reasons that Dominic pointed out earlier, that I think he's exactly right, that this is the sort of murky conflict in which it becomes difficult to determine who is winning, and it becomes difficult to interpret particular evidence as being in favor of success or not. And so, more so than other conflicts, say, like, you know, if you compare it to like a conflict like Korea, where the line is moving up and down, and you can see who's pushing whom in
a line
direction.
On a map. Is it north or
right,
south?
It's easy to see who's winning and who's not. And that's not the case here. And I think that does open the door to some of the kinds of distortions of perception or predispositions that he's talking
about.
Well,
you say that's not the case. And yet, when we talk with security experts, including those who were pretty gung-ho on getting into Iraq, I've heard an awful lot of deeply disturbed interpretation of what's going on there lately. Now, our caller, William, says, look, you've got to keep your eye on the long-term prize here. Even if things aren't going perfectly now, let's hang in there. Is that the kind of message that history suggests, Chris Gelpe, Americans will go with?
I think that the Bush administration will be able to rally some of the public to support that kind of message. That's something that will appeal to the Republican base. I think that certainly Democrats and large sections of independents are no longer looking to statements from the president for their information on the war in Iraq.
Let's go to a soldier in Augusta, Georgia. Matt's on the line. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick comment about how stretched thin the National Guard is and how frequent we're being deployed.
Have you served in Iraq, Matt?
I've served in Enduring Freedom, and I just returned from about 21 months of service, because you get taken away from your family to prepare for the mission, and then you go on the mission, and then once you're back, it's about 21 months altogether.
Welcome home, and we're glad you're here. What do you see? How did what you saw there line up with what you're seeing in the headlines now?
Well, I think if you look at the leadership, and I can't name specific names, but if you look at who's making the decisions about things that are going on the ground, and you have to ask yourself, have those people ever served in a combat situation? Have they ever carried a rifle for the company?
Are we winning in Iraq, Matt? Can you see the prospect of victory there?
Street to street, patrol to patrol, yeah, we are winning, but that's not the real issue here. The real issue here is, do they really want us there? And you talk to any soldier, this report that you're talking about, that's known knowledge. If you would have talked to soldiers 2 years ago that have been in Iraq, they're already privy to that information. And they could have told you the same thing that are coming out in these CIA reports.
So what's your message to Americans who are going to be voting in a few weeks on essentially on the future of this effort? Hang in or something else?
I think they have to revamp the whole operation. You definitely can't leave them holding the bag over there. You have to bring in more Arab influence because they don't want Western influence. You have to bring in moderate Arab countries and let them take over the mission. But that's too much of a radical approach, and there's a lot of people that will never let that fly.
Matt, we appreciate your call from Augusta, Georgia. We're glad that you're home safe. Dominic Johnson, I've just got you for another minute here. How do you see this unspooling? You've looked at lots of countries in war. What path do you see the U.S. on now in the public's understanding of this war and how it's likely to affect policy over time?
Right. Well, public perceptions of what's happening in Iraq will be absolutely crucial in determining whether success really happens or not on the ground. If you want to understand what's happening in Iraq, you have to look at how people are perceiving information as well as the information itself. A recent poll showed that if you ask people, has the Iraq war hurt or helped the war on terror, you get a completely opposite answer depending on whether you ask a Democrat or a Republican. And just in mindful of the elections coming up, you could argue that this report will play into Bush's hands because 41% of the public think Republicans are better able to do a job on terror and only 32% think Democrats are.
Dominic Johnson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're joined right now from Washington by Vincent Canestraro, former CIA counterterrorism chief, 27-year CIA veteran, former director of intelligence programs at the National Security Council under President Ronald Reagan. Vincent Canestraro, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from Arlington, Virginia, Daniel Gore, vice president of the Lexington Institute, a think tank there in Arlington. He was a member of the 2001 Department of Defense transition team. That's Donald Rumsfeld's transition. He's former director of the Office of Competitiveness in the Defense Department. Daniel Gore, thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
So, Vincent Canestraro, first to you. Here's a big new report. A chunk of it is on the table for the public to look at it. What's the bottom line message you take from it?
Well, it's a very sobering report. The key judgments are pretty much mainstream in terms of what anyone who's followed the subject would have expected. It was written last April. It concludes that the global jihadism is expanding. It concludes that Iraq is one of the four major factors contributing to the expansion of terrorism. And it really does have a pessimistic outlook on where things are going.
Does it mean that Iraq has been a failure? And what does it say about whether the country should stay or go in Iraq?
Well, there's a good news, bad news component as far as the administration is concerned, because while it does talk about Iraq being a breeding ground for jihadists and training ground for new terrorist leaders who would go elsewhere after Iraq to conduct violent actions, it does talk about the perception that would be received by the global jihadist movement if Iraq were perceived as a victory from their point of view. In other words, if the United States did abandon Iraq, pulled out, they would certainly value that as a victory, and it would be an impetus for further actions against the United States. So you've got this conundrum. We're in Iraq. It is a breeding ground for terrorists, but leaving Iraq precipitously without a perceived victory would only increase terrorism.
Daniel Gore, how do you look at the public opinion kind of consequences of this report? I mean, should Americans look at this? There are more terrorists. The trend line is not good. More rather than fewer. So they look and say Iraq's been a bust. We should throw the bums out. Or President Bush will not let this be a failure. So we've got to hang in there with him.
Well, first of all, it's not clear that there wouldn't have been an increase in jihadists even if there hadn't been Iraq. In fact, there's a famous leaked memo from, I think it was 2003, by Don Rumsfeld, where he says his concern is that they're, if you will, breeding faster than we're killing them. And that was before Iraq looked as bad as it has of late.
But if Iraq has upped the speed, doesn't that mean we've made a mistake?
We may have made a mistake initially. That was not the only reason we went into Iraq. You know, there's a laundry list we can talk about.
Yeah.
But the real point here is, in fact, Vince Canestrero had it exactly right. You're there now. We know from Somalia, Lebanon, you name it, that retreating is a surefire way of inciting even further jihadism and attacks on the U.S. and attacks on U.S. allies. And it's a guarantee. So how you leave, get out, leave, what you leave when you go is absolutely critical. And you'll notice that today's Washington Post has a number of articles. Nobody, not even the anti-Bush Democrats, are for a precipitous withdrawal. They all claim they want something better. Usually they don't tell us what it is, but nobody is saying basically within 6 months of the November elections or the 08 elections, we're gone.
Vince Canestrero, does the fact that leaving now could make things even worse, should that provide cover for the Bush administration looking back on these negative trend lines that have been produced? I mean, is there a throw the bombs out argument even if leaving now is fraught with peril?
Yeah, I mean, this is a political question at this point now. The leaks to the media over the weekend were certainly part of a political campaign, but yet the Bush administration response is a political ploy as well, because what they have done is declassify key judgments, which really don't support the White House arguments about Iraq. So what does that leave us with? It leaves us with the situation that probably is not going to get any better. When the report was written, the National Intelligence Assessment, last April, the situation in Iraq was actually a little bit better than it is now. There has been a continuing deterioration in the situation since last April. The report talks about Zarqawi and how his capture or departure from the scene would possibly improve things in Iraq, and we've seen that's not true. That's one key judgment was mistaken. Things are not getting any better. So it's hard to say at any point whether there is even any possibility of any kind of a victory in Iraq from any point of view, whether from the jihadist point of view, from the American point of view. It is not going to get any better. So then it becomes a question of what you do about it, how you disengage, and do you start disengaging now in a measured way so that you don't have to do it in a chaotic way at the end of the line.
Chris Chelpy, how about public opinion when perhaps what the public is facing, you know, is the best of bad options and very complicated ones when it comes to allotting what blame and credit for the pickle that we're in here? How does the American public begin to weed its way through this?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, and we are exactly in that kind of pickle that while we may have made a terrible mistake in getting into the situation, and now no matter what we do, we make terrorism worse, that doesn't help us answer the question of where to go from here. And I think we see that in public opinion in the way that we see a big divide between, for example, people's views of how the president has handled the Iraq issue, which there is widespread disapproval, versus views about withdrawal, where there really is not much support for precipitous withdrawal, certainly. And even in a poll I saw recently, there was actually majority support for the president's position, which is to stay until conditions allow us to leave. So I think the public is feeling very ambivalent about this and not sure how to move forward until we have some kind of a catalytic event like the Tet Offensive or something like that. I think we're going to continue in this sort of ambivalence until something, either good or bad, can push the public one way or the other.
We've talked about politicians spinning the intelligence out of Iraq and on terrorism globally. What about individuals? I mean, I see individual Americans, you know, taking the news into pretty calcified receptors somehow. People seem so hardened in the way they receive the news around positions before they even get it. Chris, you know what I'm saying?
Well,
there seems to be such a hardening of lines here.
Absolutely. I think that's true over time, and that's natural for the way that people sort of form their attitudes, that early on as you're forming an attitude about whether Iraq is a mistake or whether we're winning, that you're relatively open to information. And as you form an attitude and hang on to it over time, you invest more emotionally in that attitude, and it becomes more difficult for you to change it. So we have seen people become calcified in their views during the Iraq War. It's also part of a broader trend in American politics over the last 25 years or so, as we've seen Democrats and Republicans drift more and more apart into kind of separate Americas.
But it makes that classic American pragmatism makes it difficult for that to come into play. Let's go to Flanders, New York, and Jim. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. How are you?
We're good. What do you see, Jim?
Well, what I see from the grassroots on the ground here as a blue-collared worker.
Yeah.
Watching what's going on globally in the Middle East, you're talking about a group of people that have been preparing against infidels and being taught this through their own ideological way. As a normal citizen, you're never going to defeat it because they're being bred, like we've heard, et cetera, no matter what information we get from our government or our reporters. The bottom line is they're going to be taught this. They're going to keep breeding it. To stand the fight, we're going to have to, but the biggest losers so far, if you could see, yes, we are losing coalition soldiers daily.
Mm-hmm.
People are getting maimed. But the majority of people that are getting hurt are the Muslim population, are the Iraqi people. The only thing we could do is assist as best we can. And we cannot disregard our own home people as well.
But if the Iraq War has bred more terrorists, does that mean figure out how to withdraw from it or stay in there? Do you believe that we can somehow defeat the problem hanging in there?
Well, hanging in there, you're never going to defeat it, like I was trying to tell
mm-hmm.
you. They're being taught this since they're school children, just like we teach our children to drink milk and eat healthy. The bottom line is you're not going to defeat it, but at the same time, at least we see where they are, where we're fighting. It's hard to see your enemy when they're not in uniform, and it's a terrible thing, but you know where they're fighting. You know where they are right now. It's only a matter of time that they would pick on us or come over here anyway.
Well, I mean, maybe we know. We know that there's a lot of fighting going on in Iraq. The new report says that it's become a more widely dispersed and more populist movement. But, Jim, we've got that. Let me take a call from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Yes. I just had a point in relation to the issue of terrorism. It appears as though there's this situation that's been kind of set up, like these people over in Iraq and Afghanistan were beginning a campaign to sort of take over the world. Well, I don't see it as that. I see it more as the West was incurring in their lands and in their lives, and they're simply reacting. I mean, we're over there killing them, and it wasn't until exactly September 11th where they actually made some sort of incursion upon American soil. Prior to that, they hadn't done anything here.
Well, I don't know about Afghanistan on that. We had bin Laden and his training camps there, but Iraq, certainly the questions have been raised huge on that. Mike, thanks for your call. Janyagore, you can hear Americans struggling with this. I mean, this is a difficult thicket to get through. Where do you see public opinion tending?
I think public opinion is naturally divided because I don't think there is a center of opinion even among the elites. You're hearing a variety of views from your guests. Everybody understands this is a bad situation. Nobody has a comprehensive, if I can call it that, approach. And in fact, the problem is twofold. It is, do we look backwards and judge Iraq today from where we've been, whether it's the president's promises, mission accomplished, in and out,
mm-hmm.
bringing democracy, whatever, or do we judge it largely as a political issue as well from today forward, which is we're there, the situation can be bad, really bad, or catastrophic, and those are about our only options going forward. And that's really, I think, what divides everybody, the public no less or more than the experts.
So here you are. I mean, you've been a pretty strong supporter of this effort, and now you're saying our options going forward are bad, really bad, or catastrophic?
Yeah.
Well, doesn't—I mean, so we have to judge going forward, but Doesn't the public then have to look at who brung us to this dance as well?
Absolutely. No, the public has an absolute right to make that judgment. But what the public, I think, has done, did it in 2004, and you think you're still seeing it in the polls and the reactions, is in fact the question of going forward. Can a different set of leaders, a different government, do any better? And it is not clear. And in fact, it may be that the public is in fact seeing too much nuance among our leaders. It may have been that the better argument in 2004 or even today was that between, let's say, Bush and Howard Dean when he was campaigning, which is you're either in some form or another, or out, all the way out, completely out, the MRSA argument almost. And it seems to me that those are two clear different opinions. In most cases, even from the president's major critics, it's nuance. It's, I'll do it a little differently, I'll add a few more troops, I'll take a few out. But you're not getting, in fact, really two different opinions, which in the end means that people have to make the judgment on who do you trust to keep us safe, and they tend to still judge in favor of the president.
Let me get one more call. Steve from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, good to talk to you. I'd like to ask any of the commentators, I'm struck by when the president defended his position yesterday in response to the report,
mm-hmm.
He's making the argument that anybody who thinks that going on the offense against the people who struck us or attacked us is wrong. And it seems to me that isn't it possible that his very understanding of what being on the offense means is the very thing that the report is saying is wrong for him, which is the way he's doing it is wrong. It's not whether we go after somebody and go on the offense. It's how we're going on the offense.
So he thinks he's got a fire hose on this, and maybe it's gasoline. Vincent Canestraro, how about it? Speak to your fellow Americans who have big decisions to make here. How do you suggest they look into this thicket and figure out what to support?
They have to understand the mistakes they made at first if they want to go forward without repeating the same mistakes. It was a strategic mistake to invade Iraq as a response to 9/11. I think now President Bush will say publicly, as Cheney will say publicly, that there was no connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, but that certainly wasn't their initial response and initial conclusion. I think what's very important here is that the intelligence should be used to inform the policymakers, not to support decisions that have already been preconceived by the administration. Once you assume that, then you can get a much better idea of how to go forward. We are doing a national intelligence estimate on Iraq. It will not be released or disseminated in the intelligence community until after the congressional elections. Unfortunately, that's not going to help those of us who would like to know what the conclusions are going to be. But the situation appears to be that things are not getting better in Iraq. It's very unlikely that we can be affecting the situation in a positive way over the long term, and that eventually we're not going to be there. It's either going to be in 6 months, going to be 2 years, or whenever, but we're not going to be there. We're not going to control the situation, and local factors in Iraq will determine what happens in that country, for better or worse.
Chris Gelpy, we just got 20 seconds here. Do you see the issue as clear enough today for the November midterm elections to serve as a referendum on Iraq, effectively, or not?
I think that Iraq will be important, but I think what will be most important in terms of how Iraq affects the November elections is the debate over how Iraq relates to the war on terrorism. And if the Democrats are able to cleave those issues apart, it will do well for them. And if the president is able to bind them together, then the Republicans may hold on to Congress.
We're out of time. Christopher Gelpy at Duke University, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Gore at the Lexington Institute in Arlington. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Vincent Canestraro, former CIA counterterrorism chief, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.